We'll take appearances of counsel in State versus Sean Fenimore.
Lamar Wadler, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Fenimore.
Alexander Sean, on the same sound, I represent the Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court. Daniel P. Alexandra, from Florida, English, on behalf of the association.
Deputy Attorney General Sarah Nicoridon for the state.
Welcome, counsel. We're going to go till around 12:30. I don't know that we're going to get much beyond Ms. Lehrer, possibly Mr. Shalom, and then we'll take a break. Ms. Lehrer.
Your honors, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Your honors, the warrantless search of Mr. Fenimore's car was unlawful. The automobile exception does not justify the search for 3 reasons, which I will address in order and I will briefly outline here. The first, the car was not subject to a roadside stop. The second, there was no probable cause to search the car. And third, if there was probable cause, it did not develop spontaneously and unforeseeably. It's important to keep in mind that what the state is asking for is the application of a categorical exception to the strong constitutional preference that neutral judges determine that there's probable cause. That means an exception that has nothing to do with the facts of any case. The parameters of categorical exception have to be carefully set in order to not swallow the warrant requirement and not to undermine the purposes of this specific exception. I also want to emphasize upfront that there are many other ways that officers can get into a car to search it, depending on the circumstances facing law enforcement. Exigency and probable cause, the protective frisk doctrine, community caretaking, and consent, to name a few. This case is not about limiting any of those well-recognized exceptions to the warrant requirement, which require fact-specific determinations that it is impractical to get a warrant. This case is solely about the parameters of the automobile exception, which allow the police to bypass a judicial determination of probable cause without regard of whether getting a warrant is impracticable. As to the first issue, the search was unlawful because Mr. Fenimore's car was not subject to a roadside stop. The language and purpose of WIT are clear. When police encounter a car in the course of a roadside stop, they can conduct a warrantless search under the automobile exception. This has two components, roadside and stop. While Mr. Fenimore argues that these requirements are conjunctive, I do want to note upfront that if this court agreed with either proposition, the search of Mr. Fenimore's car was unlawful. As to roadside, the whole tenor of WIT, both the language and the purpose, discuss roadside stops. To quote this court, going forward, searches on the roadway based on probable cause arising from unforeseeable and spontaneous circumstances are permissible. Roadside, roadway, it's all over the opinion. And it's not just an idea of counting the words. It's because of the purposes that cause this court to overturn its precedent in WIT, which is that there's a danger in a specific setting on the roadside.
But no question that WIT talked a lot about the dangers of roadside stops, especially on highways, but the appellate, what's your response to the appellate division's comment that WIT referred to roadside stops, but there was no limitation, and that Colvin, which preceded WIT, had applied the exception to parked cars?
Yes, a few things. So first, to begin with Colvin in particular, that's a case that this court said in WIT was actually a pure exigent circumstances case. So in terms of Colvin, I'm not sure how much guidance it provides here. In terms of the prior cases involving parked cars, I think there's a few things that really need to be emphasized. The first is that those cases, no longer part of them, many of them are good law under WIT. So Martin, for instance, the companion case to Alston, that car was parked, unoccupied, towed, impounded, and then searched. The WIT court, this court, recognized that that's what happened in Martin, and then says later, we part from federal jurisprudence to say that a car that has been towed cannot be searched without a warrant because the right to privacy cannot be sacrificed to false exigencies.
And I don't think the appellate division relied on it.
Right.
But because it's the focus of the appellate division, what do you say is the status of Colvin post-WIT?
Well, Colvin in particular, I think, is an exigency case. That's what this court said under WIT. And certainly there was exigency. So I think the debate and some of your honors know much more about the debate than I do, but as I understand it, the debate between the majority and the dissent in WIT was, were there actually exigent circumstances in these other cases? Were they real exigencies? Were they necessary?
Right.
Colvin, in particular, this court said, yes, it talked about the automobile exception, but I think the quote is a pure exigent circumstances case. The other cases that involved parked cars involved cars that were parked and towed and searched warrantlessly, because before Witt, that was okay. And that, so my main response to the appellate division's opinion is that it failed to take into account what Witt changed. Which
so
not-
you're saying that Witt overruled not only Peña Flores and Cook, but also Martin and any other case that involved a car that was towed and then searched?
Yes. Witt refined the automobile exception. It redefined it, again, to accommodate a specific set of concerns. And in so doing, it's very explicit holding. We part from federal jurisprudence in this circumstance. When a car has been towed, you need to get a warrant there. There wasn't a warrant in Martin. There wasn't a warrant in Colvin when a car had been towed. So that's not good law anymore. So I think it's much more important to look at the purposes of Witt and what Witt was doing and what the good justification was for overruling stare decisis than to try to say, well, maybe part of Martin is still good law. Maybe part of Colvin is still good law. Witt was presented with, this court was presented with data, with a problem, and it solved that problem by redefining the automobile exception. Yes, with guidance from Alston, but Martin and Alston were decided together, and parts of Martin are just not good law anymore.
Didn't Witt, though, see itself as redefining the automobile exception to enlarge it rather than shrink it?
I don't know. I think that's a very interesting question. I think the important part of Witt is it said, we are presented with a problem. We are presented with data about this problem. And the problem was specifically about roadside stops. The Supreme Court committee was concerned with roadside stops. The data from Burlington was about roadside stops. And this court said, in Cook and Peña Flores, we thought that telephonic warrants would solve this intractable problem. That's not what's happened here. So now we need to define an automobile exception that fixes this problem. What was the problem? The circumstances that peculiarly arise in the course of a roadside stop, which is the danger, the risk of coercion, and the delay of getting a warrant.
Counsel, you're not saying, though, that the underlying rationales cannot exist in the case of a parked car, right? You're not saying that there can't be issues of spontaneity and unforeseeability. There can't be issues of security, inherent mobility. You're not saying that can't happen, right? You're not asking for a sort of a black letter rule on this, right?
So my position is that parked versus not parked is not actually the operable distinction here. Roadside aside for a second, it seems like we at least agree on what a road is. The question is then what's a stop? And what are the circumstances of a police-citizen interaction that constitute a stop and serve the purposes of Witt and the exception, the application of the automobile exception? A parked car can be stopped in that a car that is pulled over on the side of the road, the car's in park, a journey is undertaken, it was in the process of being undertaken, and then the police come up behind, lights, sirens, that car was in transit, that car is no longer free to go. That's a parked car that's been stopped, I would say, under Witt. But in
that would be called a roadside stop in Witt.
Yes, yes. So that, but the car could be parked and yet stopped.
But Colvin's a little different.
Yes, and again, Colvin, you know, this court in Witt said Colvin is an exigent circumstances case, and I think it's important to, you know with exigent circumstances and probable cause, a car can always be searched.
I'm not sure this is particularly helpful because the police couldn't search a car on the roadway that was moving.
Right.
So I think the question related more to a parked car, not on the roadway.
Yeah. So again, I think it's conjunctive. I think first you have to be on the roadway, and then I think you have to be subject to a stop. And let's think about a car for a second that is on the roadway, but has not been stopped. So a car that's pulled over on the side of the street in a suburban area, the parked in front of someone's house, the owner is on the stoop. The police come and have a conversation with the owner. It's a field inquiry. During that time, they develop probable cause that there's a stolen television, let's say, in that car. In that situation, the person outside the car has been stopped. This unoccupied and parked car that's close to the occupant was not in transit. To say that the automobile exception applies because there is a car that is on the roadside, I think defeats the purposes of Witt, because a car that's not going somewhere hasn't been stopped by the police interaction. And I would also note that something that's a little dangerous is that in that hypothetical, After Collinsville, Virginia, if you're parked in your own private driveway in a suburban area, your car can't just be searched under the automobile exception. But if you're in Newark, parked on the side of the street where you don't have a private driveway because you live in an apartment building, that car would be open for the automobile exception.
Can we park your car in a crowded mall on Black Friday and go forward now with your hypo?
Sure. So if a car is in a parking lot, that is not a road. And so under my first line argument, regardless of the circumstances of the police-citizen interaction, the automobile exception does not apply. But fact-specific circumstances that make it impracticable to get a warrant could allow for a warrantless search. And what's important here is that Witt said, because of this danger, we don't want officers to parse, in how much danger am I? In how much danger are the occupants of this car? It's too fast moving, it's too unpredictable, it's too dangerous. And so a road is a road is a road. You know, there are going to be roads that are dead end streets in the suburbs at 11 a.m. that cars stopped, and the automobile exception does apply because the bright line rule there protects officers, it protects occupants, and it also has to do with the coercion of trying to get somewhere that you can't get because of the stop. In a parking lot, which is not a through fare, people are driving much more slowly as a general matter. If someone is pulled into a parking lot, that's a safer situation to be in than the side of I-95. And if other circumstances arise that make it impracticable, okay. But that is, in every other situation, what's required for an exception to the warrant requirement. The circumstances of the actual interaction dictate whether a judicial officer can be bypassed. And it's not a mere technicality, as this court has said. You know, in Eccles, in Keaton, the right to privacy can't be subordinated to mere convenience. And it wasn't about convenience. It was about—
So we know from the example you gave us of the quiet suburban street with a dead end and there's no traffic, that the danger is not the absolute requirement.
Yes.
What is?
So I think reading Witt, the words roadside and stop are what are doing the work there. So a road, again, a road is a road. I'm not standing here saying officers should consider how big this road is. Is it a dead end? Is it one way? Is it two way? Is there a shoulder? Roads are dangerous. Stops on the sides of roads are dangerous. And so this court has said there's an inherent exigency. We're creating a category. And sometimes that category is going to be overbroad in that there is not a real exigency. It's not actually impracticable. And we're okay with that because the risk in the situation where there is an exigency that categorically we think is inherent and applies very often is significant enough that we can bypass a judicial officer who has to decide whether there's probable cause, you know, not the officer engaged in the oftentimes competitive sport of ferreting out crime, right? We want that officer to make that decision. And in Witt, this court said, except when having to decide whether you need a judge to make that decision, it's too much in this circumstance.
What impact does the presence of another individual, the passenger in the car, have on the analysis? This is someone who it would not be unreasonable to think could wake up, could drive away, could destroy contraband. What effect does the presence of that person in the car have on questions of exigency and mobility?
So in this case, the state never mentioned exigency. They never suggested at any level of proceedings that the existence of the co-defendant created any sort of exigency. That makes sense given that the car was parked in the police station parking lot. There was at least five officers that were executing the search. And according to the transcript we have of the body-worn camera, this person was so high he could barely stand up. Exigency is a fact-specific totality of the circumstances, case-by-case determination, and there's no evidence that it was met here. But it could be met, right? In other situations where it's either not at the roadside or not a stop, but the presence of a passenger in a car who could hop right over and start the car, and officers feel like that is going to happen based on the interaction, based on objective indicia of an attempt to flee or reasons to flee, that's a warrantless search because of probable cause and exigency. But Witt allows an officer to bypass not just the judicial determination of probable cause, but a case-by-case determination of exigency.
So is it your position as part of what you just said that the officer should have approached this passenger and assessed the situation?
In this case?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Before they might be able to rely on an argument that would justify a warrantless search.
I think in this case, this passenger, especially he was left alone in the car for 30 minutes. No one was interested in that car. It would be very challenging to suggest that there was an exigency created by this passenger, which is likely why the state has never raised it. But sure, in situations where the police are going to execute a search and there is someone in the car, the presence of that person is always going to be relevant to an exigency analysis or protective frisk analysis. You can do a protective switch frisk of a car.
And it bears on the mobility of the vehicle as well, no?
Sure. However, the automobile exception is not just about the mobility of the vehicle in New Jersey, and it has never been just about the mobility of the vehicle. We have the spontaneous and unforeseeability requirement. In a situation such as SMART, where a car is pulled over on the side of the road by the police, there's a motor vehicle stop on a road, call it even a, you know, MacArthur Highway, big road, right? If the circumstances facing the officers that gave rise to probable cause warrant spontaneous and unforeseeable, the officers can't conduct a warrantless search either. Not all cars in New Jersey can be searched without a warrant. And
I'm confused about your read of WIT. I thought that WIT was reading exigency out of the automobile exception and saying that the automobile exception going forward will not require a showing of exigency. Exigency is no longer relevant. So when you say that Colvin was an exigency case, but WIT says that exigency is no longer required, doesn't that mean the search would just be permitted under WIT regardless of exigency?
So I agree that, sorry, to follow the pieces for a second. First, I agree that WIT has read out a case-specific determination of exigency for cars in certain situations. So I agree there. Second, I think what WIT did was create a category of inherent exigency, you know, at the end when the court says—
Can you just keep your voice up a bit?
Please? Sorry, I apologize. When the court says whatever inherent exigency applies on the side of the road, it does not apply at the police station. So I think what WIT has erected is a situation where exigency is going to be presumed. So the question in this case really is this the situation where exigency has been presumed? And then in terms of Colvin, this court said in WIT, Colvin was not actually an automobile exception case. Colvin was an exigent circumstances case, pure exigent circumstances. And therefore the search was allowed in that case under those circumstances. What the dissent said in WIT, which I think also has a significant amount of merit to it, is Colvin was an automobile exception case. It's just that we required exigency. So in either event, exigency was present. The dispute seems to be whether it was necessary under the automobile exception, or rather, in the words of the majority, if it was a pure exigent circumstances case.
So are you saying, in following up on Justice Wayne Raptor's question, are you saying that, I think what you're saying is that WIT defines exigency as spontaneity and unforeseeability and not as impracticality?
No. So what I am saying is that there's actually three components to WIT. So we can all agree about probable cause. We can all agree about spontaneousness, spontaneity, and unforeseeability. But also there's another requirement in WIT. And the requirement is that the threshold category for the application of this categorical exception to the warrant requirement, an exception going into judicial officer, an exception of determining on a case-by-case basis if getting a warrant is impracticable, is triggered when there's a roadside stop. And so the requirement of roadside and stop, which again, I would argue are conjunctive, but one could find—
Meaning two separate requirements, right?
Yes. That is my reading of WIT. And I think something that is very important is, you know, to consider what this court said in Echol, for instance, obviously about a slightly different issue, but what this court said, and to quote for a moment, is, you know, bright line rules are salutary, but they cannot be the sole justification for a warrantless search. A bright line that remains true to an exception's roots is a worthy consideration, unquote. A bright line that does not further the roots of an exception's purposes is not a worthy consideration. Just because it's easier to get into a car, because you know that any car that you see anywhere, as long as the circumstances are spontaneous and unforeseeable, you don't need a warrant. That's not furthering the purposes of the exception as enunciated in WIT, which is about first and foremost protecting occupants, motorists, officers in this fast-moving, evolving situation where parsing exigency is just too difficult, and the coerciveness that comes from the stop. So what this court said in WIT is if a person is stranded on the side of the road and believes they have the option of saying, you can search my car and hopefully you can get away, or not and getting a ticket, the coercion there is part of the concern. It's why there is no benefit to going and getting a warrant. But in a case where someone is not using their car to go anywhere, the coercion doesn't have anything to do with getting into this automobile. It doesn't have anything to do with the purpose of the automobile exception. The other thing that this court was concerned about in Witt was the delay to get a warrant. If the delay is not attributable to getting a warrant, but is rather a 12-hour impoundment, that also has nothing to do with the concerns that made this court say, on the one hand, we have all of this danger, and on the other hand, the other concerns about privacy maybe really aren't furthered by the pure exigency analysis. But when danger doesn't exist, categorically, we're not on the side of the road, and the coercion doesn't exist because that car wasn't in transit. It wasn't going anywhere. It's not stopped from going anywhere. And in the case of an impoundment, it's not going anywhere for a really long time. Nothing about what this court said is required of New Jersey's automobile exception. Our more protective constitutional standard is furthered by saying, sure, a car on the side of the street that the occupant is outside of in Newark, if you get probable cause, it's unforeseeable and spontaneous. You don't need a judge to decide if that's true. You need a judge to agree with you. And if that car is parked illegally and it's going to be towed anyway, it's going to the police station, why would we say, well, a judge doesn't have to pass on your probable cause determination? We want judges to do that. And as this court has said again and again and again, it's not a mere technicality, right? It is an important core constitutional function for a judge to determine whether it's probable cause. So in this case, none of the requirements for the automobile exception were met. We're obviously not at the roadside. We're at a police headquarters parking lot. And it wasn't a stop. The parked car was not in transit and it was going to be towed. So there is nothing about the interaction between the police and the car getting a warrant that was the cause of delay or a cause of coercion.
How does Courtney fit into your analysis?
Sorry?
How does the case Courtney fit into your analysis in the appellate division?
Well, I think it's wrong. And luckily here in the Supreme Court, I don't have to say otherwise. I think that this court, the court in Courtney recognized that Witt doesn't actually just have two requirements. It's not just probable cause and unforeseeability and spontaneity. They call it the location requirement. Rodriguez calls it the location requirement. Okay, so we're recognizing that Witt isn't just two requirements. Everyone's agreeing to that now. But I think in Courtney, the emphasis on a car is not towed until it's towed is misplaced. Because once the police say, this car is not going anywhere because of the operation of law, because we've already called the tow truck, because of the decision that we've explicitly declared, there's no delay for getting a warrant. They have the car. They should go ask a judge, hey, do we have probable cause? And I think one of the assumptions underlying Witt sometimes was, well, they do have probable cause, so why should they go ask a judge? Sometimes they don't. That's why they should ask a judge, because the judge is the person who has to decide whether we should get into this car. So in Courtney, in the situation where the car is definitely going to be impounded, the motorist isn't going anywhere in that car saying, hey, search my car, that's fine. That's not going to allow them to keep going, so the coercion is not there. And they're not going to continue on their journey or wait on the side of the road while a warrant is gotten. 12 hours, they're finding some other way home, right? There's no point in saying, but you don't have to go get a warrant, other than a bright line rule, which again, I think Echol is probably the clearest pronunciation from this court of, we don't just do bright line rules because it makes things easy for the police. Bright line rules have to further the purposes of the exception, and they are exceptions. You're supposed to go get a warrant.
You're saying in Courtney, mm-hmm. or a situation like that, none of the Johns Law exceptions can be met? You can't have somebody drive up and say, actually, I'm the owner of the car. I'm sober. I have a driver's license. I'll sign whatever attestation I need to sign. I want to take my car. Sure. You're saying that can't happen?
I mean, maybe it could, right? So I think in a case where we're considering impoundment, we have to look, as we do in every other exception to the warrant requirement, and as we do for every probable cause assessment, what's going on in this case? John Law says you impound it for 12 hours unless someone at the scene of the arrest can take it away. That is going to be generally a fact-specific determination that's not that difficult. And in a case where there's objective evidence that this car is being towed, as in this case, then there's no excuse. And even in Witt, when this court said, when you tow to the police headquarters, they said headquarters, you have to get a warrant because the right to privacy cannot be surrendered for fake exigencies. When we know the police are going to have the car for long enough to get a warrant, they should get a warrant. I can talk.
Please go ahead.
I was going to move on to probable cause, but I'm here for more questions about roadside stops.
Let me ask you this, because you touched on John's law. What, if any, role does the doctrine of inventory searches play in this matter? Not in this particular case, because we have the officer testifying that he was conducting a search to find an intoxicant and there was no evidence of a standardized police procedure. But in another case where the car is about to be impounded or has just been impounded under John's law, does the doctrine of inventory search apply?
I think because inventory searches are usually, they are a standard procedure that explains how and where in the breadth, they're not necessarily coterminous with the search for contraband. So I think in a case where there's a potential inventory search, that might be a case-by-case consideration, maybe in particular under inevitable discovery. But if you're going to take the car, first you take it.
But let me ask you to pause there. So if the police had a standard procedure for John's law cases in this regard that called for an inventory search, any problem?
I mean, assuming that the SOP is reasonable in scope and purpose and all that, probably not a problem.
Please,
I'll have
ahead.
To think about that a little more.
Okay. But then what's the remaining, if anything, of the statement that you're relying on from Witt that says we part from federal jurisprudence that allows a police officer to conduct a warrantless search at headquarters merely because he could have done so on the road? Whatever inherent exigency justifies a warrantless search at the scene certainly cannot justify the failure to secure a warrant after towing and impounding the car.
So this court knew what it was saying in Witt. It knew about the existence of inventory searches. And I think that the difference between saying you have to go get a warrant after you tow this car and saying, well, because of inventory searches, maybe we don't care, is that there is differences in when and how and what degree police different police departments conduct inventory searches. They're not all as thorough. And they have to serve specific purposes that are different than the finding of contraband. So I don't think that it's a one-to-one search. And so that's why this court in Witt, aware of inventory searches, said, if you tow and impound the car, you need to get a warrant. If there's going to be an inventory search, that's a different kind of search. And, you know, it would follow the rules of that search as established by the procedures of that police department.
Sorry. So just to make sure I understand, post-impoundment, inventory search without a warrant, totally fine. But you still need a warrant for some other kind of search. Why would the police ever do an other kind of search instead of just doing the inventory search without the warrant?
My understanding, not having briefed this issue, is that inventory searches and searches for contraband according to warrant are not exactly the same thing in many situations. It depends on the standard operating procedure of each law enforcement agency, what they do when they impound a car. So we can't
assume that the extent of the search, the depth of the search,
yes,
may not be the same.
Yes.
Inventory searches are done, as I understand it, primarily to inventory the contents of the car, create a list so that there's no later concern about theft. Do you agree with that general characterization of the purpose of them?
Yes, but the inventory searches also have to be set out in standard operating procedures that show that this is what happens in this agency when a car is impounded for this reason. And different law enforcement agencies do have different policies on this and create different searches as a result of them.
But they don't exclude, for example, the glove compartment or the trunk. They presumably, if they're going to be looking for items that are left in the car, they're presumably looking in both of those locations.
I think it really does depend on the circumstances of when a car is towed for illegally parking and brought to a station, an impound lot. I don't know if all of those are actually subject to an inventory search. Which cars are subject to an inventory search, I think, also depends police station by police station, SOP by SOP. I think it's true that sometimes there's going to be a significant amount of overlap. But saying sometimes for some cars in some situations, well, we wouldn't need a warrant anyway to look for contraband because we can find it in this other way is not a reason to read the automobile exception as allowing for a specific kind of warrantless search.
I wasn't looking to hijack the argument with inventory searches, right. And your memory of the doctrine is quite apt. So we'll hold that for a case where the parties actually argue.
Thank you.
Before you move on, though, to your next segment, the two sentences that Justice Wiener Apter read, do you read headquarters and impoundment lot to be referring to the same place or two different places?
With said headquarters, this court, again, knows what it means when it says headquarters.
It said headquarters that was followed immediately by a reference to impoundment lot, seemingly as if the court was referring to the same thing. Are you saying that the first sentence refers only to headquarters and the second sentence refers only to impoundment lot, and the court was not intending for those two to mean the same thing?
What I'm saying very candidly is I don't know what an impound lot is. I don't know if every police station has an impound lot. I don't know if it's 5 feet from where Mr. Fenimore parked. It's just a specific driveway to an impound lot. I have no idea. And because I don't have a burden in this case and there's no information from the state, I don't know. I really don't know. And I think if this court wants to clarify that until a car is impounded, then that doesn't satisfy the WIT requirement, the thing that we have to be careful of is why would you impound a car? It's 5 feet from the impound lot at this, you know, this remote barracks. It would be very easy. One thing that this court noted in Smart is how easy it would be to tow the car to a nearby impound lot. Why would we ever do that? Because we'll just search it here without a judge saying, yeah, you have probable cause. That's a reasonable thing for you to do to go search.
But you're not saying that the impound lot was 5 feet from where Fenimore's car was parked at the Woodstown Barracks. So you're not saying that.
I have no idea. No. I'm saying there's nothing in the record. It's the state's burden. And this is a case where literally everything was challenged. You know, we don't often see a case where below all of these arguments were brought up. They said WIT doesn't apply because this wasn't roadside, because this wasn't stopped, because there's no probable cause, because it wasn't spontaneous and unforeseeable. The state was on notice. If WIT stands for nothing else, we have learned it stands for putting the state on notice. The state was on notice that it had to put forth any evidence that goes to any of these elements. And so I have no idea what this barracks in Salem County is like. I don't know if he was even in public visitor parking. Maybe it's one of those situations where you come to an arm and you say, hey, I'm here, I have an appointment, and I don't know. And that would be the state's burden to show, and the state didn't do that in this case.
Why don't you move on to probable cause,
please? Sure. Probable cause. So even if an automobile exception could apply to a car parked at police headquarters that was already determined to be impounded, the other prongs here weren't met, starting with probable cause. So there was no
argument, sorry, just to clarify, it's disjunctive. So if you were to win on any one of the three, there would be no need to reach any of the other two, correct? Yes.
Roadside, stop, both in
terms. So it's actually four part, kind of.
I was told not to make it sound as complicated as it might be. That was the number
one. I already have them numbered. Roadside, stop. PC, spontaneity, well, unforeseeability.
I mean, the way I was numbering it before my first moot was roadside, stop, that the car was in transit when it was stopped, not going to be impounded. So there's the delay doesn't stem from looking for a warrant. Probable cause, unforeseeable, and spontaneous.
Why don't you talk about probable cause?
Yes. Okay.
Come up to eight.
Sorry. He warned me. Okay. So as this court made very clear in Chipperell, probable cause to arrest and probable cause to search are not the same thing. A finding as to one does not necessarily mean there's going to be a finding as to the other one. In this case, I am not disputing that there was probable cause that Mr. Fenimore drove while intoxicated. It's very clear. The question is, did the state put forward any facts to establish that nexus between the probable cause of the crime to arrest and this place to be searched, the car? The answer is no. There's not a single fact here that does not exist in every single DWI case that would suggest that in this car, there's going to be evidence of the crime of driving while intoxicated. Autry, one of the cases that the state relies on, discusses a burnt spoon with crystalline residue on it, an 18-inch piece of elastic, a baggie with crystalline residue. Other cases discussed in the briefs have open containers. Those are facts. They're not a lot of facts. It doesn't have to be probable cause, I understand, is a low burden, but it's not an automatic rule. You don't get to get into a car just because you've arrested someone for driving while intoxicated. And people get intoxicated in lots of places. They get intoxicated at home and they get intoxicated at restaurants and people get intoxicated in the office and some people get intoxicated in their cars. And so any evidence that would suggest here this person got intoxicated in their car or there's evidence of the fact of intoxication in the car, that's all that would be necessary. But that wasn't met here. Okay.
Can I ask, how does that square with Ireland?
Sorry. I think there's two options. The first is that Ireland mentioned that there was the odor of alcohol coming from the car. It didn't say coming from the driver. So if there's the smell of alcohol coming from a car, I think there's probable cause that there's an open container of alcohol in the car. The second option is that Ireland is not in keeping with this court's jurisprudence about particularized objective facts. And I think it is time for this court to clarify that, because Ireland is a case that is relied on in the appellate division and in the trial court to stand for some sort of automatic right to search when there's a DWI offense. And that just does not comport with every single pronouncement this court has ever made about particularized facts to support the search in a specific case.
What about the officer's observation of Fenimore's behavior as his quote unquote hysterical screaming, and the officer's inference from that, that there was potentially incriminating evidence in the car?
I don't think it's a reasonable inference. I think someone being upset about being arrested does not provide a nexus to search their car for evidence of a specific offense. I'd also note that the fresh track marks, they didn't explain how fresh they were. In Autry, again, a case that the state relies on, there was, excuse me for being a little graphic, but coagulated blood on the track mark. That's a fresh track mark.
And people react in various different ways when they're asked permission for consent to search, when they're told their car is going to be searched. So it would be a very difficult standard or rule to find right. In cases like this with regard to just someone's reaction to being told their car is going to be searched, that's the probable cause that Absolutely. Provides the nexus that there might be contraband or evidence of criminal activity in the vehicle.
He's also high. So I'm not, you know, his reactions are not necessarily that of an ordinary person. And also, as we get from the recorded interrogation, not the interrogation before the search, he was afraid of losing his job, right? Like people are afraid. People are afraid of getting arrested. They're afraid of their cars being searched. If that gave you carte blanche to search anyone's car without a warrant, there'd be a lot of warrantless car searches. Spontaneity? Okay. So as this court said in Witt, and then again in Smart, one of the main ways that we're protecting the rights of New Jerseyans in the privacy of their car is the requirement that the circumstances giving rise to probable cause are spontaneous and unforeseeable. That standard is not met in this case, and I'd just like to take a brief moment to talk through the steps that were taken in this case as probable cause developed. There was a prior harassment complaint, and one of the allegations was that Mr. Fenimore had driven while intoxicated. Then we don't know when that was. We don't know if that was weeks ago, months ago. We don't know. Armed with that information, Mr. Fenimore is called. He sounds high. The police officer says, "Why don't I take you?" And Mr. Fenimore says, "No, I'm going to drive to the police station." So a person that we know might be high is driving to the police station. Then he arrives. He's driving as promised. He is high, as the officer already said, and he can barely walk when he gets out of the car. He's interrogated. That interrogation is not recorded, but one thing we know from the record is that he was asked whether he was high in that interrogation. So they were furthering the investigation of the DWI during that interrogation. And then they gave him field sobriety tests. That is a very well-developed, multi-step investigation to develop suspicions into probable cause. And that's exactly what this court said in Smart requires a warrant, because if you have the time to plan this and to develop probable cause and to do an investigation, you have the time to ask a judge if you're right, if you have probable cause. And again, that's the point of Article 1, Paragraph 7, is to get a warrant, to make sure that a judge, a neutral and detached magistrate, agrees with you. And in Witt, this court said, sometimes the burden of finding out if a neutral and detached magistrate agrees with an officer is just too high, but not in all circumstances. And to go to my earlier argument, not when we're not at the roadside, not when there's not a stop, but also when the police officers are taking a deliberate investigation that has many steps and is under their control to develop probable cause. It's good police work. And at the end of it, you need to call a judge and ask for a warrant. Briefly, unless you tell me not to, Well, for all of these reasons, we counted five. The automobile exception does not apply. And the state never argued at the trial court that any other exception applies. I want to make three really brief points about the search incident to arrest exception. The first is that it was never raised at the trial court. It also wasn't raised in the response to my petition. The second is that this isn't unresolved under New Jersey law. It's very, very resolved. Eccles says we're following Chimmel and we're limiting the search incident to arrest exception as to automobiles for situations where there's a destruction of evidence or danger to the police rationale. In Gant, the case that the state says, well, this court hasn't had a chance to pass on, in the Gant 2 exception, the second exception, the court said, we're parting, quote, it does not follow from Chimmel. We also conclude that the circumstances unique to the vehicle context justify this Gant 2 exception. So this court has already said, we're following Chimmel. And what happened in Gant, the development, was the Supreme Court saying, we're not doing that. I will also note that when you read automobile cases from other courts between Belton and Gant, the Belton 2 exception was already in play. Courts knew about it, which is the eventual Gant 2 exception. So this idea that this court hasn't already passed on this question is just incorrect. This court has the problem that this court hasn't had the opportunity doesn't exist. And suggesting it at this point is certainly not the special justification to even entertain overruling Eccles. And the last thing I'll just ask is if this court is going to consider it, I would request an opportunity to brief this issue. I was only able to address it in my reply brief in the appellate division. I didn't even address it in my supplemental brief before this court because it was not raised in the response to my petition. And if we're going to be considering even overturning well-established case law from this court, it should certainly be briefed.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.